Yeah, Marty, any color commentary you can provide about conversations you may have had with the SEC regarding where they're going with 17A5 and how that might interact with where you may be heading standard setting wise? I mean, you know, any rule that talks about notifications via telegram, as is articulated in the dialogue here, is probably in need of a refresh. But I think it's important, as Galen mentioned, to appropriately sequence where the SEC may be heading with the rule and how that might relate to standard setting.
We have been having dialogue on a regular basis recently with the SEC, and one of the issues I'll point out that is challenging is right now is that 17A5 requires, as Barbara had indicated, an audit that would provide reasonable assurance about any material inadequacies existing pertaining to the accounting system or the internal controls or procedures for safeguarding securities. The report, however, that's been filed under the AICPA guide, I think as you probably know, indicates a study of controls was done as part of planning the overall audit, but accordingly we do not express an opinion on the effectiveness of the company's internal control. So there's an existing disconnect between the requirements and the report that's been received. So that's one of the issues that we're working on is what should that report look like and what should be the procedures governing it. And we've been having some regular conversations with the SEC. Brian, I see your card is up, and so why don't you take the floor?
Thanks, Marty, and this is probably a particularly good time for me just to express the standard disclaimer, since this would be an area where rulemaking is likely in light of the Dodd-Frank Act, but it's been pointed out, and it's fair to say, that the principal requirements that we're talking about here today have been in place for well over 30 years, and so I think this does certainly provide a good opportunity to reconsider those requirements. But notwithstanding that, today's rules that have been discussed and summarized in the requirements of 17A5, certainly in terms of the net capital rule, the possession and control rule, and the box count rule, are certainly a good place to start and have served us well. So the staff will certainly be thinking about that. In terms of the PCAOB's comprehensive oversight, I think an important question to really be thinking about here today is what transition time would be necessary to move to using PCAOB standards as opposed to the standards of the AICPA, and really looking to the current SEC rules as a starting point for that discussion, notwithstanding that the staff may have some recommendations for improvements or enhancements to that rule. And as has also been pointed out, it's certainly fair to say the staff is aware that the report being accepted today may not fit squarely into the existing standards, but the audit guide does provide some background, I think, that bridges that report a bit. So clearly it'll be a coordinated approach, and I think, you know, the conversation and dialogue is very useful around what the PCAOB might be able to think about in terms of updating their standards in this environment.
Thanks, Brian. Kurt Schacht?
Thanks. This is pretty confusing issue for those of us that are sort of on the outside looking in at the auditing policies. What happens in the context of a publicly traded broker-dealer? Is PCAOB looking at any of these customer safety issues in the context of those audit reviews?
There are, to the best of my knowledge, very few publicly traded broker-dealers. I mean, they're part of a holding company where the issuer is not the broker-dealer. The issuer is the holding company that may have other activities. And I think most broker-dealers, some of the larger ones, are embedded in a holding company. And so the issuer's financial statements that we've had inspection authority over, we've been looking at the issuer's financial statements and the audit of those financial statements of the holding company, and not necessarily the compliance reports of subsidiaries, I think could be fair to say. Barbara, can you comment further on that?
No, I think that's fair to say. And fact, I think I'll go as far to say is that I'm not aware that there are any standalone issuer broker dealers left. And so the significance of the broker dealer subsidiary would vary depending on how material it is to the holding company's financials.
Yeah, Kurt, no. We're not looking at anything over related to the custody of customer funds at those entities.
So this would be, from our perspective, the audit standards of the broker-dealer standing alone and the compliance reports and the standards with respect to those compliance reports would be a new activity for us, as would be the inspection of the broker-dealer. Denny Beresford.
I'm on the board of a large public company that has about $650 billion under management. A very, very tiny portion of that is with respect to broker-dealers. Most of it is registered mutual funds and other forms of asset management. My point is simply that as you study this, I urge you to look at similar businesses. I believe there's a investment company audit guide that arguably has identical practices. I'm not sure if there are any others that are similarly situated. And as you look at this, I think that you should be concerned about precedents that you might be setting. I'm not suggesting that there are any particular problems here. I think that the assets under management are the big issue, as others have already suggested. But I'm simply saying, as you look at this, I think you should be aware of other practices in similar businesses at the same time.
Thanks. Bill Gradison.
Simply like to call to your attention that the board put out for comment a proposed confirmation rule, and this has direct implications here. Generally speaking, at least in my experience, when we talk about a box count, most of these securities are not in the possession of the broker-dealer. They're somewhere else. They may be with another broker-dealer. They may be in an electronic form somewhere else. They may be floating around quite literally in a street name. They won't have the name necessarily of the broker involved. And therefore, some of the challenges that auditors are facing with regard to other forms of confirmation, disclaimers and so forth, conceivably could arise in this area as well. So I just want to connect the dots in terms of that. We weren't thinking, I don't remember our talking about the broker-dealer context when we talked about confirmations, but it's not irrelevant. And some of you, as you think about commenting on that, while we didn't specifically ask about that, might have some useful comments to make as it might apply in the future to broker-dealers.
Thanks, Bill. Doug Anderson.
Yeah, I wanted to make some comments on development of the audit standards in this space. And I've never audited a broker-dealer, so I can't say I have deep industry expertise, but I've done a lot of audits. And as I think about what this issue is, it doesn't look like a typical financial statement audit. It doesn't look like basically the environment that audit guide was really set for. And when you go back and think about whether we should start with a clean sheet of paper or whether you should be starting with the audit guide, I'm a little concerned about thinking of the audit guide, of updating the audit guide and tweaking it, because I just look at the material in Appendix C with the report there and the obviously discontinuity between a disclaimer of opinion on controls immediately followed by an opinion based on a study. And it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I would really encourage the board, thinking about establishing a standard, to start where Barbara suggested. Understand the risk. What problem are we trying to solve? Think about the risks. Think about how you then will address those risks and design the standards around that. While it's not to ignore this audit guide, it really needs to be focused on what we're trying to really accomplish and not starting by updating something that I, by my brief observation, looks kind of flawed in trying to solve this problem.
Thank you. Jeanette Frenzel?
In fact, I was going to make much of the same point there that Doug did. I think you really need to come to terms with what this opinion really means, and is the current model really addressing that level of assurance? And then, based on risk, what do you really want an opinion on? And there is a loose parallel in the government world where we do require opinions on compliance for recipients of federal funding who carry out government programs. And there's a standard to deal with that opinion, and there's also a regulation, and there's also an audit guide. So I think you need to look at all the different levels that might be needed here.
Thank you. Damon Silver?
I confess, like some of the, I think like Kurt, I'm not sure I fully understand all this, but I have two general observations about it. The first is that it appears to me that Congress, in its infinite wisdom, knows what it wants, but not who it wants it from. And that it may not be too late to get at least a little clarification on that question. It appears that what Congress wants and what I know the public wants is some greater degree of assurance that what broker-dealers tell the public is in their accounts is actually there. That sounds pretty simple to me. Getting that assurance seems, after the last round of 10 or 12 comments, to be extraordinarily complicated. But it appears to lie somewhere between the PCAOB, FINRA, the SEC, and perhaps FASB, which hasn't been mentioned in this conversation. It strikes me that if the PCAOB wanted some greater degree of clarity, that it might be possible in what remains of the time before the Dodd-Frank bill is voted on final passage to have some sort of colloquy or the like among the sponsors of that bill that would direct all these various bodies to work together to achieve the goal that I mentioned earlier. There are certainly people involved with the PCAOB who know far more about these procedural matters in Congress than I do, but it strikes me that's at least one thing that might be done that might facilitate the interagency aspect of this. Secondly, let me just say that substantively, it seems to me, again, in a very kind of sort of ignorant way, that what we're looking for here, it appears, is to have a process by which it appears that what Congress would like to have is to have auditors look at customer accounts and make sure that what's there is there. And so then the question is how to make that happen. I couldn't tell you how to make that happen, but it strikes me that if you get Congress to say that clearly to everyone who has responsibility for it, maybe that would help. Second point, Bill Gradison's mentioning confirmations. In doing, it seems to me it's increasingly the case that in the securities markets, and in things related to the securities markets like derivatives, we live in a world where acts with legal and accounting consequences occur with less formality than used to be the case. I think that maybe that's fairly Bill's point. The parties involved and their counsels to these transactions seem to have not a lot of problem in defining who has what asset, liability, and obligation. Meaning that whether it's an OTC derivative settled by a phone, entered into by a phone call initially, or a holding in a security that is evidenced by any of the things that Bill mentioned, private parties don't seem to have much of a problem knowing what's what, and it strikes me that there's not that actually that much lack of certainty here, and there ought to be a way that the PCAOB is able to define clearly in the course of its oversight of auditors of broker-dealers whether or not they're doing an adequate job at determining what the actual assets and accounts of the broker-dealers are.
Thanks, Damon. Jim Schnur.
Marty, just in terms of getting your information around your background, the AICPA has an expert panel with respect to broker-dealers. I think there are a wealth of information in terms of not only what the existing practices are, but also understanding the stock record, which is, I think, the focus of what the audit procedures would be, how that interrelates with the other records of the company in terms of their financial statements. And I think they could be very helpful in terms of developing, you know, what the objective is, what the understanding of the records are, and then formulating, you know, what the audit procedures ought to be and how they ought to, if they need to be changed from what's, you know, what's currently performed.
Thanks. We have reached out and had the expert panel visit with us and talk about how they're performing audits today, and we've had discussions in that regard. So we are, good point. We've been doing some of that outreach already, and we'll continue to do that to understand what has been done in the past. But I think one of the key things is they can talk about what has been done in the past, but there aren't a lot of standards and written standards today with respect to that. So one of the things we sort of find out is if you looked from one audit to another, you'd probably see a lot of differences, especially around this aspect of reporting on the safeguarding of assets that aren't in the financial statements, and the reporting on controls is probably quite variable because of the lack of existing auditing requirements in that area. And that's, I think, our biggest challenge is what writing what those requirements would be around auditing something that's not in the financial statements, that's not disclosed. As I think Barbara touched on before, it's sort of the unique situation there. But your point is still good. We are reaching out to FINRA, the SEC, having conversations a lot with the SEC, and expert panels and others. I think it was Lynn and then Barbara Roper.
Thanks, Marty. I would wholeheartedly agree with Wayne that you really ought to start with the existing audit guide. I think it provides a good starting point. I would bring into that, though, an examination of the enforcement actions that have occurred at the SEC. And I think as you dig through those, you'll find that quite often the problem in this area is just a lack of expertise and supervision. Firms that have gotten in trouble have tended to put younger, junior people on these audits and haven't adequately supervised them. They're not aware of all the laws and regulations, and as a result, they don't get to the heart of the issue. The other thing, and this has been highlighted in by the recent financial crisis, is with the broker-dealers, often we find that the auditors just really didn't understand what the broker-dealer was doing and the full scope and everything that the broker-dealer encompassed, including, as Barbara's noted, the off-balance sheet stuff. And so I would certainly enhance that audit guide in those areas to make sure that people are actually starting to really understand these things, because they can be extremely or get into extremely complex transactions at times. On top of that, I would bring in the Yellow Book requirements. I think Jeanette was dead on. And I would bring in the full piece of the Yellow Book, including the notion of some form of negative reporting with respect to laws and regulations, because in this area, if the auditors hasn't really got in and understood all that, there's just no way they can really be doing an audit. So certainly I'd encompass that into the audit guide, including the possibility of a separate report in the area of laws and regulations and compliance as well. Denny made a good point. I, too, serve on the board of a mutual fund complex, and it ties in with what Bill said. These securities are often held by a custodian in a trust someplace, and it's becoming much more important from the perspective that funds have done much greater allocations to foreign investments, if you will. And we're finding as you start to invest in some of these foreign instruments that it's gotten very tough, if almost impossible, to be able to get a confirmation
out of some of those foreign countries. And in some cases, the laws actually prevent them from providing that confirmation back to the auditor, especially in some of the Asian countries. So I think it's very important, even in your confirmation proposal, that you take on this issue, because it affects not only broker-dealers, it affects all 40 Act companies and anyone that's holding or having securities held in those foreign countries by those custodians. And the auditor isn't going to get a confirmation. That's just the bottom line. So in those countries where you can't get a confirmation, we definitely need some guidance, some good guidance on exactly what we'd expect the auditor to do in those situations. And the more of that you can build into the current proposal before you finalize it, the better off I think you'll be in the long run. If you use the current audit guide, though, as a basis, I don't think this is going to be a real long-term project. I mean, you've spent 8 years on confirmations. I would hope we wouldn't spend 8 years. And any time I hear anyone in Washington, D.C. saying it's going to take a long time.
It's only six.
You know, it makes me nervous. I think you can get that expertise and get around your hands around it in a reasonable time without taking another 6 years to be able to put out a standard in this place.
Thanks. Barbara?
Yeah, 2 points. One, building on what you said, you know, in terms of reaching out to SEC and FINRA, it strikes me that the primary responsibility for overseeing the broker's custody of these securities is still a regulatory responsibility that resides with others. So it's going to be primarily an SEC or FINRA responsibility rather than a PC, that your particular role is looking at the role of the auditor in that process. And so some of the best guidance, I think, on what is effective or what procedures are appropriate to try to inspect for or audit for this custody of, you know, proper custody, safeguarding of customer securities is going to come from sources like FINRA and the SEC in terms of looking at what they're doing, how they go about it. And I know you're already having those conversations, and I think that's useful. But I think at the outset there needs to be some thought about exactly what the auditors, you know, where they fit into this picture, because you can't write their standards until you know exactly which piece of this puzzle is going to be their responsibility. The other thing that strikes me is that the big risk here is where you have self-custodying. You know, I mean, that's where the risk levels, that was the case in the Madoff example. A lot of these examples that you're talking about, with investment companies, they're probably not self-custodying. So you already have a third party in that process where there's some independence. So the big risk factors in terms of problems that are likely to occur are going to occur where you have the broker-dealer who is self-custodying. And then I think you have to look at a much more robust set of audit procedures in order to assure that everything is appropriate.
I agree. Good comments. Thank you. Sam Ranzilla?
Well, I think it's important to recognize here that, you know, in addition to the guide, there are attestation standards that exist with respect to a report on compliance or reports on controls over compliance. So, I mean, to say we're starting with a fresh sheet of paper, I think there are solutions within the standards. There might be a need for practice aids or something, but you can't really answer that question, in my mind, until the SEC makes a decision on what they're going to do to amend 17A5. And I think it's really important, and I think I'm stating the obvious, so I'll back off, but it's very important to be fully coordinated with the SEC on this, from both the perspective of the writing of the standards, as well as the transition from the old regime to the new regime, that, you know, appropriate considerations with respect to that transition period, and how quickly both broker-dealers and auditors can integrate that into their processes.
Thanks, Sam. Bill Gradison?
I'd just like to say a word about expectations. One of these years, the SEC is going to replace me, so I'm just speculating on what the future may bring. But I think the sum of what we've discussed, what has been discussed so far, is that next year is going to be a learning year. When I set a blank sheet, all I mean is you can't take our current auditing standards and apply them. Furthermore, if our inspectors go out and work against the documents that are already in use, what are they inspecting against? And that all has to be filled in. So, you know, realistically, I think it'd be quite miraculous if this program were truly operational until the year after next. And I don't say that with a great satisfaction, but I just think one has to be realistic about what's involved. In other words, I think of 2011 with regard to broker-dealer audit oversight is somewhat like 2003 with regard to issuers, where we did limited inspections, and they were very useful, but they were limited in their scope as compared to what we were able to do a year or so later.
Yeah, certainly with respect to the audits of the fundamental financial statements of the broker-dealer, many of our existing auditing standards would be entirely appropriate with respect to the audit of the financial statements of the broker-dealer. The biggest issue might be these 500 or so firms that are just registering with us that are not used to certain new standards that we've issued, such as our documentation standards or EQR and other things like that, that they would have to get up to speed on. But there's probably some other transition issues as well, as Bill's talked about, and I think Brian mentioned before, of suddenly authority is given to us, and what's the appropriate transition period to move from what auditors are currently doing today to something else. And I agree with all the comments that have made that there's lots of stuff to consider. There's audit guides, there's knowledge at FINRA and the SEC, there's attestation standards and other tools that we can start to build upon. So we acknowledge that and don't expect a six-year process to get this done, Lynn. We understand it's going to be a degree of urgency around this, but clearly something we have to approach with great care, given the fact that we're talking about custody of trillions of dollars of assets, and we're all aware of some of the frauds that have taken place and how monumental they were. So we certainly want to make sure that the right standards are put forth. Neary Buxman?
Thanks, Marty. Just a quick observation is what strikes me, that there's an element here, and maybe beyond the scope of the board, for some, you know, principle-based construction and engineering, no pun intended, in the context of AICPA guides. But if you think about the need to audit information that's not in the financial statements and apply some verification processes, the need arises in many other areas. It's very high on my mind now in the context of emerging Reg AB, securitization transactions, and looking at some things that are not on the financial statements. Another element that comes to mind, and I know how it falls within the realms of the broker-dealers, is insurance separate accounts. And it could be somewhat related, because it's also an element of financial statements of insurers, and it's a build-up of all the separate accounts, notwithstanding the fact that it's not directly on their balance sheets per se. Or perhaps it is, I'm not sure how you treat it, because it's a line below the financial statements. But in this regard, what strikes me as interesting is to think about, one, perhaps it's a second opinion rather than and something you can couple. Two, create some building blocks, perhaps together with the AICPA, of what does it mean to audit something that looks like this and feels like that, rather than creating a unique artifact that is solely for broker-dealers. And that can allow you, should there be, the next request will be to get the PCAOB overseeing some attestation reports associated, for example, with emerging Reg AB. So it's just a thought whether some thinking could be expanded beyond simply broker-dealers in conjunction of a larger exercise.
Thanks, Neary. Good points. Galen Hansen?
Yeah, it seems to me, and Sam mentioned this as well as Neb right now, the attestation standards, it almost seems to me that that is more of where you're going rather than the traditional audit financial statements. I did have a couple questions, Marty. How are they? Have they even mentioned how often these are going to? Are we looking at triennial audits like we have right now? Or has there been any discussion of that, or whether these inspection reports would be made public? As I understand it, the existing Section 70GA audits are not even made public, right? Those are filed with the SEC and they're not even subject to public scrutiny. Is that the case?
I think, Galen, and Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, broker-dealer financials can be filed on a confidential basis with the SEC. They are required to provide their customers with an audited balance sheet audit at least once a year, but the 17A5 report, and that would be kept confidential if they so request.
The way the legislation works is we'd simply have the discretion to set an inspection schedule, and you might have a different frequency schedule for different types of broker-dealers.
Sam Ranzilla.
I just wanted to follow up to Bill's comment. I think a timeline, Bill, that you're talking about with respect to using 2011 as a bridge allows for the appropriate time to both set the standards for the SEC to modify their rules. So I just wanted to say, from my perspective at least, that sounds like a very reasonable approach.
Lynn Turner.
Another source of information for you, Marty, I think, is to sit down with the actual examiners at the SEC. Not necessarily the headquarter people, but you should go spend some time with the examiners or broker-dealers in the regional offices. These are the people, and there's some. I know there's some former Big Four auditors in some of those regional offices that are actually in examining these broker-dealers, and I think they would be an invaluable. I found them an invaluable source in the past of information. And they've got the auditing skill set, plus they have probably the most in-depth knowledge of broker-dealers of anyone within the commission. So I would certainly try to reach out to the regional offices and get your hands on some of the people actually doing the examination of the broker-dealers.
Good. Thanks, Lynn. Well, hopefully, I'll turn this back to Barbara in a second for some summary comments, but hopefully we've tried to at least put the issue on the table and explain why there's some challenges here, and we've certainly gotten a lot of good advice in terms of where we should go with next steps. Brian did talk about transition issues and looking at 17A5, and then certainly we'll look at other guidance that exists and standards that exist to try to draw from that. With respect to the unique aspects of the broker-dealer, not their basic fundamental financials, but the unique aspects we talked to. Barbara?
Thank you again for your comments. I think this will be very, very helpful to us and very informative. I guess just two topics I wanted to briefly throw out since we have about 10 minutes left. And I think they've been touched on in some of the remarks. And one has to do with maybe any views or suggestions on this issue of outsourcing. It's been a good part of my career in financial services, both on the issuer side and the auditing side, and I think there is a lot of outsourcing. And then, you know, we could talk about getting SAS 70s, but then you go to the SAS 70 and there's a two-page list of subservicers, which are really not covered, as my understanding is, under the SAS 70. So one is if anyone has any views or suggestions. I think that we may find with some of these broker-dealers that the outsourcing arrangements are significant. And it will differ very much from broker to broker. And the other issue is, I know this gets more back to the broker-dealer financial statements, but it's important in customer protection, which is I recently read that even though we seem to be kind of on the economic recovery path, there have been a number of broker-dealers that have broken their net capital requirements this year. And they're not the largest ones, but they're not insignificant. I think one in June had 300 independent representatives that broke their net capital and are now in liquidation. So I don't know if anyone has any views on whether this, looking at the net capital requirement, since it's as of a point in time, if there should be any other considerations that within the next month net capital might not be adequate. Damon?
I wanted to respond to your second question. We've seen a fair amount of sort of volatility in the equities markets, meaning that we had extraordinary volatility in 2008 and early 2009, then a period of relative calm, and now in the last 3 or 4 months, a return to higher than average volatility. And I think these kinds of conditions support the concern you raised in your second question. I think there's also would also be reason for concern about sort of capital over time. This is less a small broker-dealer question than a large broker-dealer question. Due to the availability to large institutions of very cheap short-term finance now for a protracted period of time, and I think it's likely, although it's very foolish to make these kinds of predictions, I think it's likely that that's going to continue for a while, at least if the Fed Fed statements are to be believed. I think that creates a circumstance where broker-dealers are very vulnerable to a market break of some kind, and where there isn't, I think, the underlying stability in the financial markets to make that type of break implausible.
Lynn Turner?
On the second point, as Damon mentioned, there's a lot of volatility, but I mean an auditor his job is to opine on those financials at a point in time and not to try to be forecasting out what's going to happen in the capital markets. I mean, we're having a difficult time forecasting out what's going to happen in today's market, let alone what's going to happen over the course of the next year. And there's already the obligation on the part of the auditor with respect to going concern. It almost seems like it's more of a disclosure issue from the context of what the broker-dealer is going to disclose in terms of capital and contingencies around that capital and the ability to maintain their net capital over the course the going year. And in a world that's so volatile, I think maybe you emphasize the going concern requirements, but trying to get out beyond a year is almost impossible these days. No one seems to be doing a good job on it, so I'd be careful in that respect. As far as the outsourcing, I assume you're talking about the broker-dealers outsourcing some of the stuff like the custodianship and all.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it just gets back to the point I made earlier, that the auditor really has to understand exactly what the nature of the operations of the broker-dealer is, who's doing it, and who's responsible for that stuff. And I think that's where the breakdown has come in the SEC enforcement cases, because the auditors tend to look at just what's on the balance sheet and not what's missing. And it's not just broker-dealers. One could say that has to do with a lot of the off-balance sheet problems we've had.
Okay. Thank you. Damon, did you have another comment?
I'm not sure, Lynn. I may not have expressed myself clearly. I was not suggesting that auditors ought to be trying to forecast capital markets. That would be very foolish. What I was suggesting was that in the course of opining on the fairness and accuracy of the financial statement as a whole, that auditors ought to be looking a single moment in time in terms of measuring the capital adequacy of a broker-dealer could be misleading in a sense that it's possible to engine it's not only possible, it's quite easy to engineer financial statements around a single moment in time. And the auditor ought to be paying it. For the reasons I said earlier, an auditor ought to be paying attention to the capital levels over time within the firm, not predicting them for years to come, but looking at them in the current year in a broader way than just a single moment. Even if the reg requires in particular that the broker dealer have capital at a single moment.
Gail Schroeder.
Yeah, I think there is actually a requirement, and SEC can help me out on this. I thought there was actually a requirement for all broker dealers to monitor on an ongoing basis their capital requirement. And it seems like as part of the audit process itself, the auditor should be looking at their ability to comply with this regulation along with others. So I think Damon's right that we're kind of there. Maybe it needs to be spelled out more in the procedures.
Arch?
My memory may be failing me here, but I do think the broker-dealers, don't they file monthly focus reports? And those focus reports have the net capital computation in, if I recall right. So from an audit perspective, I think Lynn's right. If a broker-dealer's get into a net capital problem, it raises a going concern issue. And you see information throughout the year from these focus reports as to their net capital, and those net capital computations take into account haircuts on securities and so forth. So there's a lot of information with respect to that.
At Wayne, Collins?
Just a slight add-on to that. There is, as part of the 17A5 and as part of what the auditor is reporting on right now on the material inadequacies, is the companies making the periodic computations of net capital. So I think that handles what the fluid performance during the year.
Well, thank you very much for your comment. I'm sorry, was there one more comment? Doug? Sorry.
Yeah, I just want to get back to your other question on the outsourcing of the activities. I mean, at the end of the day, if an auditor is going to give some kind of attestation or opinion on whether it's accuracy of records or adequacy of procedures and controls, they're taking responsibility for that. Now, if they're relying on the work of somebody else or information that's coming from some other party, they have some obligation to have some basis to decide it's accurate or it's supportable. I know my view has always been you can outsource whatever you want, but you can only outsource the activities. You can't outsource the responsibility. So if the auditor is going to give an opinion in some way, they have the responsibility to make sure that opinion is supported regardless of who's doing the activity. So I don't see it as a complicated topic. It's a topic that auditor has been dealing with for decades. It just may be a little more extreme here, which means there has to be a very good risk assessment before the auditor can decide what to do. Maybe a more complex risk assessment than it is in other situations, but it's not a new topic.
Thanks, Doug. Well, again, I think by bringing this topic to the SAG today, we wanted to address something that was going to be before us, we think, very shortly based upon legislation, let you know that we've been having conversations with the SEC, FINRA, expert panels, et cetera, and that we're planning to address this matter on an expedited basis, understanding all of the importance of it and the risks involved. So thanks very much for the input. We're going to try to take a short break, about 15 minutes, and then we're going to turn to our next topic. Thank you.